This podcast is for entertainment purposes only and does not replace your own financial, tax, legal, or financial product advice.
Well, hello again, Australia. I'm Glenn James and you are...
John Pigeon.
Now, today we are talking about the most banging, sexy subject of all time, and that's tax.
It's very interesting, isn't it?
John, if I say one word to you and that word's tax, what comes to mind?
Boring.
Well, fair enough.
What about you?
Bill. Yeah. So, just to kind of, before I introduce Sarah, our professional guest today, you know, it is tax time, and a lot of the time with our tax returns, there's no point doing a tax episode in July, because if you need to make some changes or do some planning, you really want to do that a lot of the time as an employee in June. And if you are a business owner, I might do another episode over on My Millennial Business just around some tax things there. But today we're pretty much talking about employees and maybe some sole traders, and, you know, we'll keep it pretty high level. There's an accounting firm that I send a lot of listeners to, Altus Financial, and Scott has been on the podcast in the past. Scott Young, he's the managing director. Full disclosure, Altus Financial is my personal accountants. I pay them a fee, but we don't get anything in return for sending anyone to them to do their returns. So, having said all that, Sarah Pike, welcome to My Millennial Money.
Thank you, guys.
Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you for the introduction. I don't know whether I sound dull or exciting.
Well, we'll look at the reviews in about a week. Now, Sarah, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Myself? Well, I'm actually from Tasmania. So that was where I was born and bred, and I've been in this game for probably 14 years. It makes me sound really old, but yeah, I don't know. I guess I've just always had and further to what I do as a career, I've always just had a really big passion and interest in financial matters, whether that be property investing, financial planning, all that sort of thing. That, you know, I wanted to set myself up so that when I was older, I didn't repeat, you know, the steps of my mother, and sort of be financially independent, make my own decisions, and be able to, live life on sort of your terms and do what you want when you want.
Mm. So it's more of a case of, yeah, I'm passionate about this for my own personal situation, but now I want to help others by understanding the numbers and getting them a good result as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, tax is one of those things that it's almost like a foreign language. And even when you're doing it, you know, there's some things you have to read twice, upside down, back to front.
Yeah.
So I totally appreciate that, you know, coming at this for the first time or coming at this without the day-to-day knowledge that I have, it can be extremely confusing and extremely frustrating.
Mm. I find, don't know about you, Glenn, but I find in this space I just need to take one bite a day or a week and just get little bits of information here and there, and then slowly you've got this whole kit bag of knowledge that you can take and apply, but leave it to the professionals, I say.
Totally. Before we get into it, Sarah, yes. Do you like your job as an accountant?
Do I like my job, or yep. Do I like working with Scott?
Is either that your way. Question, Glenn?
No, you know, I actually do. And, you know, I actually work on the outsourced CFO side of our business. So I work with a lot of, you know, sole traders as well as businesses, and help them with their business and advising on that side of it, whether it be, on the tax side of things, whether it's for their accounting and bookkeeping, things like that. So, there's that helping element. Like with everything that we do, we're helping them to, whether it be doing their tax or making their business better or just making themselves and their personal financial situations better. Yeah. So it's all, at the end of the day, it's all about helping.
Awesome. Well, let's get into this episode. It's going to be just Q&A, guys, from questions from the Facebook group. So let's get it on. Okay, so there's a heap of questions today. I put in the Facebook group a little while ago if anyone had tax questions. The first heap are ones that have the most likes. So I'm just seeing that as the most popular ones.
Yeah.
So the third one down there, John, because I didn't put them in order, it's from Ashley Carden. Do you want to read that and see if Sarah can answer that?
Let's do that. So Ashley says, what you have to do if you own and have sold shares / Bitcoin / micro investment apps, etc.?
Yeah, now this is Bitcoin. This is, you know, hot topic right now. So look, with Bitcoin, it has been taken that it is like any other share. So it is in the capital gains, what we call the capital gains tax realm, and taxed accordingly. So with anything like a share, Bitcoin, any of those assets, when you sell that share or asset, there will be either you've either made profit on it or you've made a loss on it. So you've either basically sold it for more than you bought it and you made a gain, profit, or you sold it for less than you bought it and you've made a loss. And it will be taxed at your marginal rate. So although we call capital gains tax, it's not a separate tax. It's taxed at your marginal rate. And that will just go in your tax return with everything else under that capital gains section.
Okay. So it has a 50% exemption, does it, if you hold it longer than 12 months?
That's correct. So you must hold it for longer than 12 months. And then you do get that automatic 50% as an individual. There are different taxing depending on if we're talking about other entities, but 50% if you're an individual and you've held it for longer than 12 months.
So as a practical example, if someone was earning $70,000 a year and they sold $10,000 worth of shares, but they purchased the shares for $6,000, so we've got a $4,000 gain, because it's been more than 12 months, half of that gain, being $2,000, would be added to their tax. So it would be as if they earned $72,000. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes. So it gets added to the rest of your income, and then less any deductions to get to your taxable income for the year, correct?
Yeah. Just on the micro investment apps and investment stuff, if you've got an app like Raise, Spaceship, you might have Vanguard Personal Investor, you might have, you know, insert your product here, they will send you at the end of the year, and it's called, I think, is it still a consolidated tax statement or a tax summary or something like that?
Yeah, normally a tax summary, like a financial year tax summary. Yeah. Correct.
And what do people see on those pre-filled ones from product providers?
They'll categorise everything. So they'll talk about, purchases, sales, that then go through into, they normally have like a bit of a cash summary as well. So you'll see your inflows and outflows, and then also a capital gain sort of register within that. So it will talk to what you sold during the year, and basically all the elements that you need to calculate that gain or loss. So they're very good,
yeah.
And they're really handy, and CommBank and all those ones sort of do those.
And I guess the difference is if you buy shares yourself through Selfwealth or E-Trade or a broker, you're going to need to get all that information together yourself, your accountant. There isn't an automated report.
No,
that's correct. So look, the ATO does have very good visibility over 99% of things, and they'll report on everything they do know. Quite often they might actually come up on there and say, we know you sold this, but we don't have any more information. So that's where we will need that information from you to get the granular detail of what you sold and how much and what the gain was. So the ATO still doesn't have a reach on some of that stuff.
So would they be telling you, the ATO would be telling you prior to that or after the fact?
No, well, so we only get that. So that report comes out once a year. So that's like what we call this pre-fill report. So that will come out basically post 30 June.
Yep.
So we'll find out after the year's over. Anything like that, just, keep your records and sort of, have everything jotted down.
So as an example, the pre-fill report, and it sounds like a dumb question, but this is kind of new stuff with the way technology's going. We don't get given PAYG summaries anymore.
Correct.
So on the pre-fill report, does that include everybody's quote-unquote group certificate, PAYG summary?
That's correct, yes. Look, that's from an accounting side. That's what we use for preparation, and that's what we can see on our side. As individuals through your MyGov, you won't see – it does actually ask you, do you want to pre-fill your form? And that's essentially what they're doing. So you won't see what we see, but they then pull that information from their systems and go, okay, well, we've got all this. They pre-fill each of your labels, and then you have to check it and make sure it's correct.
And that includes any interest from bank accounts?
Yes, yes. Look, it's not 100% accurate, but 99% of the time they will have most things. But like I said, when it comes to granular detail like the sale of investments, that's where it gets a little bit shaky.
So you can't hide, Glenn.
You can't hide.
No, you can't.
You used to be able to allegedly hide profit from cryptocurrencies before the ATO cracked onto this. But now I believe the Australian-based exchanges and a lot of exchanges are reporting to the ATO.
Yeah, now, because originally, I'm not 100% sure on that, Glenn, but originally the ATO didn't know how to tax cryptocurrency. Mm. So it sort of stayed in this realm. It was almost like cash, but it wasn't. So it wasn't until they really came up with a methodology to treat it like a share in any other asset that there would be an obligation now to report that sort of stuff. So, yeah, not 100% sure on that, but it definitely is classed as an asset, hence why they would be looking for that information.
Because I know last financial year when Rosie was doing my tax return, she said, oh, I need the info from Bitcoin sales. I'm like, what? How did you know about that?
What Bitcoin sales?
Yeah, but it turned out that was some reporting in the background, and the ATO, like you said before, they said, we know you did some type of activity.
Is that right?
Can you just let us know?
You say, I know nothing.
No.
Not me. Someone else. Wrong name.
All right. There's a question. Thanks, Ashley, for that question. But I think it just speaks to the more complex your investments are, the more of your own record keeping that you need to do.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and if you're looking at multiple investment properties and things like that, it does, you know, if you don't have someone else managing these things for you, there is a lot of paperwork and a lot of things that you need to have jotted down and sort of have saved. And particularly with a lot of the share stuff and even crypto, and particularly with shares, a lot of it's still paper-based. Mm. So you get a lot of, you know, things
crazy,
from that. Yeah, so you need to kind of keep that, you know, print it in or scan it in or do something with it, because you will need it one day.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you've probably chucked it, or it's, you know, it's gone.
Yeah. But I realised this week, we bought a car last week, and I just like, right, I'm going to get this right this time. I'm going to tell my accountant today that this is a date, this is a stamp duty, this is a...
Nice. Well I'm done, like, John.
Well, proud me, because I've not done that in the past, and it's a pain in the butt to then go and retrospectively look back, geez, what date was I purchasing
that?
Yeah. So we've got to remind ourselves on the way in, don't we?
Sarah, what's the best DIY record-keeping solution for individuals and their tax?
Look, it sort of depends on, I guess, what your for things like shares, because they are so paper-based and they'll come from multiple directions, that's really going to be a matter of collating that, scanning it in, and having an application on your laptop or on your phone. Because there is even, you know, apps from your phone, like Scannable, that will then PDF something that you take a photo of, and then you can store it within your device. So there's things like that. But, you know, if it's investment property and stuff like that, you can talk about whether it's managed or it's or you're doing it yourself. Personally, managed is so much easier because they have it all for you.
Totally.
And you just go back to them and go, okay, and then my annual summary, let's go.
But I would even say if you've got access to Google Sheets or Microsoft Online, just do a spreadsheet. Mm. Like if you make a donation to a charity of $20 in the street and they give you a receipt, or if you buy some work shorts or work shoes, just put the date, what the item is, and the amount. And then at the end of the year, whether you're doing the tax return yourself or your accountant, you're going to need that information.
Correct. And look, a lot of stuff is electronic. So even, you know, when you do make donations for other stuff that's not in the street, you'll get an email.
Mm.
So generally, I would file those, have subfolders for those, and you can actually, you know, keep it all that way.
Yeah, okay. So making it really basic example here, I bought a coffee downstairs an hour ago. And that went the receipt went straight through to my email.
Mm-hmm.
What would you now do with that? You'd put it in a subfolder, would you?
Yeah. So look, in your case, you do have an entity, don't you, John?
Yeah,
so,
it was a business meeting.
Yeah. So you could use something like a receipt bank and put that straight through to your Xero file.
Yeah.
In the case of an individual, then if you do have that electronic copy, then yeah, you could just, I would save that in a subfolder and be like, you know, meetings or entertainment or something like that. You know, I have them each for, you know, whether it's insurance or donations or property, and I have them sort of categorized that way. So it's definitely an easy way of doing it. And I leave them unhighlighted, so I come back to it because I know that that relates to the current financial year.
Yeah. Just on John's expense claim, because there's people that run businesses that listen. If you have a business meeting with two people, strictly speaking, only half of that you can claim.
That's
because you can't claim your own.
That's correct. Look, entertainment's one of those.
Gotcha.
What I was on my own. I was a meeting with myself.
Well, you can't claim that, mate.
Yeah, entertainment is one of those ones. It's, you know, it's a necessary evil. You have to do it. You can't run businesses. You can't do things without a level of entertainment. But it is caught in that at FBT realm, as well as being non-deductible to some extent, depending on the number of, you know, clients versus staff that are at that event. Mm. So,
yeah,
always got to be wary of that one.
We're on to you, John.
Mate, I didn't say I claimed the whole lot. I've just merely asked, where am I putting my receipt?
In the bin, because it's not a business expense. All right, let's move on.
50% of it is.
All right. Okay, mate. There's a question here from Claudia, and this is a popular one at this time. Claiming work from home costs like electricity, office furniture, and Gemma Walker also says, what's the go with work from home expenses? She thinks last year there was a 52 cent an hour option or 80 cent an hour, or is it better to manually calculate? So lay of the land, a lot of people are working from home at the moment. Melbourne's been locked down 58 times in the last 10 minutes. So this working from home, what do we need to know?
Yeah, so look, the ATO did kind of complicated it last year with their COVID relief incentive, which was to put in another rate. So Gemma is correct. There is a 52 cent rate, but also an 80 cent rate. Now, the 80 cent rate was the COVID one where they said, well, if you want to claim the hours that you've worked from home, put in 80 cents an hour. But the only caveat to that is it covers everything that you've been doing at home. So you can claim no other working from home expenses except for 80 cents an hour. Whereas with the 52 cents, which has historically been there, 52 cents has always been the working from home rate, or it would be indexed, but that's been available for a number of years. But that, you claim the 52 cents for the hours that you worked. But you can also claim your internet, your telephone bill, your home printing, you know, and those sorts of things, home office, depreciation of a home office assets and things like that. Whereas 80 cents, you can't do any of that. It's right. Just 80 cents per hour for the number of hours worked.
And in your experience, which one ends up the better option?
52 cents.
Yep.
And then adding everything up.
Correct, because everyone has internet, everyone has mobiles, and that quite quickly adds up.
This is really amazing because, you know, when I had my last business, you know, the handful of staff came to the office, worked from the office in and out. Now with Simo, with all the podcast staff, you know, there's four people that basically work full-time from home.
Mm.
So in terms of the government and tax deductions, I would say to my team, make sure that you've obviously got a diary, but yeah, how many hours a week are you working?
Correct.
You know, what's your electricity bill? Because it can add up.
Correct. Yep.
Yeah, so it's just such a big deal. So what's a practical example if somebody's working from home and their electricity bill is $500 a quarter, like there's a family or something, how are they working that out? Are they prorating? Or prorating, how do you say that?
Yeah, prorating. Look, it is, you sort of have to look at, when it comes down to things like electricity, you sort of have to look at the square meterage of the home that you're using. Mm. So if you have ideally a designated home office space or a room, then you would sort of say, okay, this space is 10% of the total home, floor you know, area. Size and floor yep. area.
It's going to be a lot of people working out of their office room.
A lot of measuring going on.
Yeah.
Big deck out the back.
Yeah,
so that's kind of how it comes into play for things like that. Now, just bearing in mind, working from home expenses, it doesn't then extend to things like your mortgage or your rent. So those sorts of things are off the table if you're an employee working from home. There's carve-outs for those sorts of things if you have a business and you have signage and you have people visiting your home. But for employees, all of that sort of thing is not deductible.
So for employees, does it change by industry or is it pretty standard?
No, look, it's pretty standard. It's a working from home rate. So that rate makes no difference depending on whether you're a doctor or an accountant.
Yep.
It's purely just for the hours that you've worked.
That's really cool. So I just want to really clarify this because there's so many people that work from home now.
Mm-hmm.
52 cents an hour, then you can look at the prorata usage of electricity, gas for heating.
Your laptop.
Telephone.
Internet.
What about amenities?
Amenities as in?
Toilet paper.
Like
the coffee. Talk to your accountant.
Yeah, look, I think you might have a hard time to say there's, you
really?
Know, business
coffee
use
machine?
Of your, you know, I think it's more personal use asset there.
Yeah, sure. Okay.
But, yeah, so, yeah, look, the 52 cents an hour has generally been the much better option just because 80 cents, you do lose out on all those other things.
Well, the government also want to make it easy for people just to
they
claim
do.
It.
And that was the reason they brought the 80 cents in.
Yeah. So generally speaking, and it's a very broad question here, but people working from home now claiming they're 52 versus going into the office and not being able to claim essentially anything, do they actually come out on top, do you think, in a lot of cases now?
From working at home?
Yeah.
Look, at the 80 cents an hour, when you actually calculate it across the whole year, unless you're working 7 days a week, 8 hours, you know, 10 hours a day, it's not a huge amount of money. You know, we're not talking thousands, no. We're talking hundreds of dollars. So if that is the difference between you kind of, yeah, wanting to get ahead, it's probably not the way to go.
But also you're better off because you don't have transportation, you're probably not lunching.
That's right, you're saving on other things.
Lifestyle-wise,
And look, certainly last year, like when everyone did go into lockdown, people went out and bought monitors and, you know, chairs and whole fit-outs for their office. So there was a lot of expenses incurred last year that we could then deduct. This year, you'll probably find most people have already done that. So in 2021 and 2022, then the expenses of the home office have gone down and it might just be the cents per hour that you're actually claiming for.
If someone purchases a new stand-up desk because they are working from home now, can they claim 100% of that cost or just a prorated hours in the day off that capital amount?
It's more, it more sort of comes down to, well, is that desk 100% work-related or is there a personal private portion?
Yep.
And with individuals, that's always a really hard to gauge. You know, 100% is a very hard target to really reach, you know, unless you do not go into that room and use that desk for any other time of the week. You know, if you're browsing your laptop and you're on the internet and you're using that desk, you know. So look, 100% always a bit of a red flag to the ATO. So I would generally say, you know, you want to go, you want to, you know, if it legitimately is, then great. But 100% is one that you just really have to be able to back.
Yeah.
So it's always one that, yeah.
The 80-20 rule is safer.
It is.
Yeah, it just,
like
it is
John
hard.
John drank 80% of his coffee
on
work time.
Yeah, it's hard to argue that you've never ever used it for personal use. It's like telephone and internet.
Yeah.
You know, unless you've got two phones, one's definitely work, the other one's personal. There's always a personal portion.
Yeah. But it's just good to know, and this is why I think it's so important. Talk to an accountant, you know, reach out. We'll put a link in the show notes to speak with Sarah's team and, you know, I don't mind people paying to get accounting work done because they might pick up things that they might have missed otherwise, and it really does make your life easier. Let's have a look here. Do you want to read a question from Trista Coco, John?
Yes. So Trista says, deadline for contributing additional funds to super with intentions to claim on tax.
Yeah. So the thing with super is it's very strict. So it has to be in before the end of the year. And when I say that, the 30th of June each year. So, and when I say it has to be in, it actually has to have left your bank account and be in your fund. And this goes for anyone. This goes for companies. This goes for individuals. This goes for, yeah, for everybody. If it's not actually physically sitting in your fund by the 30th of June and you've done and you must do that notice of intent to claim as well, which goes to your super fund, then it will be disallowed by the ATO.
This is one of my favourite changes to the tax laws and rules probably in a long time where, you know, at the end of the financial year, if you've got 20 grand in savings, if you've got 10 grand in savings, if you've got 5 grand in savings and you're like, well, I don't know where to invest this for the future, I'd like to do something with it, you might make the call to transfer, you know, 2 grand over to your super fund, invest it for the future, fill out an intent to claim form with the fund. Mm-hmm. The fund will then take the 15% contributions tax. And then that amount, the 2 grand, the 10 grand, whatever you want to do, as long as you're under that cap, and we'll get to the cap shortly, that could be a good way to pick up a tax deduction on the way through to the end of the financial year and invest some money for the long term in super.
Yeah, no, look, it's certainly an option. I guess the only thing we normally just voice our opinion on is the fact that once it's in there, it's gone for a very long time.
Yeah, it's locked away. Yeah.
So if you're really a long hold type of person, that's perfect for you. But it, you know, depending on how old you are, then you're not going to see it until you retire. So it's just something.
And that's why I preface like you might. So if someone has 10 grand of savings and they want to do something with it, well. If you don't know, we're probably not putting 10 grand in super if you still haven't bought your first home.
Correct.
But you might go, look, I'm going to put 2,000 in. I'm going to put 1,000 in.
Yeah, and obviously a lot of people follow the advice of the accountant, don't they? And a lot of times it's actually the accountant's thought process that determines what they do. So they could be really pro-super regardless of your age versus someone that says, like you've just said, well, yeah, if you're 25, you've got 30 or 35 years before you can access it, think hard before you go and do it.
Yeah, and look, it does depend, coming back sort of what you touched on, Glenn, is, you know, have they bought their first home, or is there other things that are coming up in their lives? Are they starting a family? There's other things that will be, you know, quite heavy on the funding, and locking away that sort of money for the next 30, 40, 50 years just may not be the most feasible option. Although, you know, in saying that, there's always salary sacrifice as well as an option. So I actually personally do it, and it's only a couple hundred bucks a month, but I figure that that's better than doing nothing. The compounding effect on that year on year with the interest, is a good way to start. Correct.
Yeah.
If you get a pay rise, then you can, you know, essentially salary sacrifice the top of it off, and you don't really miss that amount.
And just on the super caps, so you can put in up to $25,000 per year as a concessional contribution, but it includes what your employer puts in.
That's correct. Yes. Yep. So it's whatever, it's less whatever you've already had received as super guarantee from your employer.
So for example, like, there are plenty of people who listen to this podcast who've got lots of money and would legitimately cap out that cap each year.
Mm-hmm.
There are plenty of people just starting out, or, you know, doing it tough on a disability income or whatever, where, you know, shut your ears, it's just not for you right now. But if your employer had put $10,000 in before the end of this year, this financial year, there is a serious call to make. Well, if I've got a crap load of cash, do I put 15 grand in, at least get to the cap and move on?
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's a legitimate strategy, and that's why we want to release these episodes before the end of the financial year. So at least you can do a bit of a autopsy before this episode. Today I sat here for an hour with Roz, and we were just doing some end of year tax planning for me, for the business. You can do that for your own life.
Yeah.
Well, that's right. And look, honestly, you'd want to be making that decision and actually processing that amount by about the middle of June, because they do get busy, and you would just want to make sure that it's in there before you miss the boat.
Yeah. Let's have a look here. Stacey Moffat, first year as a sole trader. Any tips or hints? So it's her first full financial year as a sole trader. So if you've got a new client who just started their own business, you know, June last year, July last year, what are you kind of saying before they come in to see you to do their tax return?
Yeah, look, as a sole trader, you're almost still in that you're in that individual realm. So you've got an ABN, and you're running a business of a sort, but you're still really bound by the things that apply to individuals, because at the end of the day, you just do an individual tax return, and that's just, it falls out into the business section. But there's sort of no additional specific things to a sole trader, and because you can't really pay yourself a wage, you don't have those sort of added deductions that you would have in a company or other entity. So with everything, when we're looking at obviously tax, we can either prepay our expenses, bring some things forward and try and reduce our taxable income, or the other side of that would be your income and you know, either somehow reducing that or pushing that forward into the next financial year. But it would just be looking at, well, is there anything that you can bring forward for that that trading entity? You know, can you prepay some supplies, or you can prepay your accountant. I do have clients that do that.
Really?
So, yeah.
Music to your ears.
So you can bring things forward and prepay them. It's a timing difference. Obviously, you need to keep doing it then every year. Mm. But, you know, if there's anything like that she can bring forward, then that would be something to look into.
Yeah. And I would probably say as well, like, if it's your first full year, let's make a scenario up. If they said, yeah, you've earned 50 grand or 40 grand and you need to pay $4,000 in tax, you're going to get a bill for $4,000. Then what happens?
Once you do fall into that realm, because you wouldn't have prepaid any tax for that year, you then go in what we call the pay-as-you-go installment system. So that's where you actually prepay your income tax for the next financial year. Now, that can happen to everyone. So even as individuals, if you had a large tax bill, you would automatically fall into that system in the year after that return. In the case of sole traders, once you start making profit, because you're not having that income tax taken out by an employer, then you will fall into that system naturally, and you'll have to keep up those payments once a quarter.
So likely, if your tax bill was $4,000 in the first year, once you put your tax return in and submit it, they might say, all right, you're now paying $1,100 a quarter.
Correct.
Because we're going to get a little bit more from you because we're going to assume your business will grow a little bit.
That's right. Yeah, that's sort of what they look at. They do look at the last year to then preempt what you'll pay for the next year.
Yep.
And I guess coming back to our super point, for someone like a sole trader, that super contribution is super important because no one else is doing it for you.
Mm.
So if you're not doing it for yourself, you're literally not putting anything into super.
Yeah, it's an interesting balance in that first year of running your own business as a sole trader, isn't it?
Well, that's right.
You want to stay cash heavy, but you're wanting, generally speaking, you're going to be spending probably a lot more in your first year because of the setup costs and buying your new tools. And
well, and it's funny you say that, John. Like, I've just pretty much about to complete the first full financial year of Simo Interactive, the podcast business, because I was running it through my trust before and we wanted to set it up. So this is the first full financial year. And we're doing the exact same things. Like, Roz is like, get your bookkeeper to pay the super for the staff for June in June.
Yeah.
So we're not going to pay it. So we're just going to try and cram everything into this financial year.
Mm.
And then the installments are going to start once we lodge the return.
Yep.
But I will say, you know, in terms of super and being a sole trader, don't necessarily freak out too much in the first year.
No.
Because we want you to be able to pay your rent or pay your mortgage.
Correct. correct.
Get to a point where you might be like, look, we've earned 80 grand a year. If I was employed, I'd be, you know, getting $8,000 because it goes to 10% next year.
Yeah.
So can you put, you know, even if you just did $800 a month?
Well, that's right. And it's just
cash flow it.
Exactly. Just putting it aside. You know, with companies, we're always saying, like, you know, if you're going to have sort of a GST savings account, for example. So when each quarter you have your liability due to the ATO, you know, you've already got a bit of surplus there. That's kind of, you don't touch it. That's for your GST and your BAS. And the same sort of goes particularly for sole traders. You know, if they can chip away a little bit and just go, okay, well, here's an account for my ATO liabilities, even if that's, $100 a week or something minor, that at least it builds up there and they know that that's specifically for that use. Yeah.
So on the theme of sole traders, Monica Tram says asset write-off for sole traders. What could we buy now as a write-off?
Yeah, now as a sole trader, because like I said, they are virtually considered an individual, there's actually no immediate write-off for a sole trader. So that's only for the business realm, for the companies. But, you know, there's still the depreciation rules. So you can buy something, although it might not be deductible straight away tomorrow, you can depreciate that over the life of the asset. So for a laptop, for example, that's 3 years. So you can buy that laptop, it'll just take you 3 years to get the full deduction for the cost of the laptop.
So let's just do a basic assumption. If the laptop was, or the piece of equipment was $1,000. The first year tax return, you're not claiming the full $1,000. You might only be claiming 30%.
Well, that's right. Yeah, depending on when you bought it and, you know, all those sorts of things.
Yeah.
And your actual marginal tax rate, because you'll obviously get the rate. So for a laptop, it's 66.67% is the deductible amount per year.
Right.
But then you get that deduction. So say you get a $1,000 deduction on a $3,000 laptop, but then you obviously only get the deduction at the marginal rate. So if your marginal rate is 30%, then you'll get 30% of the 1,000 is actually what is your deduction.
And I would encourage any, because I want to move on from sole traders, because I can cover more on the My Millennial Business podcast. But, you know, if you are a self-employed person, you need to stop doing your tax yourself and you need to look at either getting a good bookkeeping system or a bookkeeper depending on the size of your operation. Because you just need to focus on what you're good at, and that's running your business, not worrying about tax. So I'll take that as a comment, Glenn. We'll take a quick break and we're going to come back with some questions about dividends.
If you're after personal financial advice, don't get it from a podcast. If you would like help based on your own personal situation, head over to sortyourmoneyout.com, click get help, and we'd be happy to introduce you to one of our trusted advisors. Our panel of advisors, mortgage brokers, and accountants work with clients all over Australia so they can connect with you wherever you are. That's sortyourmoneyout.com and click get help.
All right, we're back. There's a question from Holly Smith. Do you want to read a question, Sarah?
Oh, sure.
Yes.
Yeah, giving me the biggest question on here.
I know. It's because I'm still
timed that
dying.
Perfectly. Yeah. All right. This question's from Holly Smith. This will be our first tax return where we will need to declare dividends. Can we do this via the online MyGov tax return system? And the shares are in both mine and my hubby's name. Do just one of us declare or split 50-50? So absolutely. So that can be done through MyGov. Now, with dividends, and when I was talking about the information the ATO has previously, 9 times out of 10, they will have that data, particularly if it's a BHP or if it's a big entity. If it is a private company, that'll be unlikely, but certainly a listed company will be there. So that will most likely pre-fill into your actual MyGov. Now, the fact that they are both your names, again, the ATO will most likely already know this. In with the interest accounts, when there's more than two people listed on an interest account, it automatically splits at 50-50.
And is that because when you set up a joint bank account with somebody else, it asks for both people's tax file number?
Yeah, quite possibly, but it also knows that there's more than one person. As soon as there's more than one person on a particular account, it basically counts each of those people and splits it accordingly. Yeah. It's like when, you know, parents have accounts on behalf of their children, those will come through automatically and be split.
So again, I like practical examples because I'm a bit basic. If there was dividends of $5,000 for the year, instead of one person having a tax bill for an extra $5,000, it's smoothed out to $2,500
each. That's correct.
And if there was any of the franking credits?
That's right.
They would be halved and credited to each individual person?
That's right. So everything's split 50-50 straight down the middle. There's no, unfortunately, there's no benefit to one or the other where they could take all the franking credits and you get nothing.
Yeah.
It's an automatic split down the middle.
Yeah. So when people, like if someone wants to get started in share investing or something like that and there's a lower income earner spouse who might want to be a full-time homemaker and do the kid thing or might just not want to work or whatever that is, talk to us about what usually works out in terms of tax and the reason why, where you might set up that share account in the lowest income earner's name.
Yeah, well, look, naturally, and I guess when we talk about the business realm, we deal with, you know, a lot of families and their businesses and then how we can split the income across those families. And the same goes for individuals. If there's a partnership and one of you earns, you know, twice as much as the other, or you do have, you know, a partner who's on maternity or parental leave and paternity leave, then you would naturally go for the person with the lower amount of income because you're naturally going to get a tax advantage there because they're just going to be paying at a lower marginal rate than the other person.
Do you get this after the fact, or do you generally get clients come to you and say, look, we're buying some shares, how should we structure this, what's the percentages, or whose name should we buy them? Or do you find out at the end of the year and say, oh, I bought these shares 5 months ago, I'm just telling you now?
I would love to say that I find out beforehand. I would tell you 99.97% of the time I find out afterwards.
Right.
Look, with shares, generally you're dealing with a much smaller sort of portion and percentage. One thing that we do also talk about though quite a bit is property. So we do have that on the property side of things, and you will find, you know, maybe 50% of the time they will actually come to you and ask you about that.
Only 50% of the time.
I would, yeah. It's
might do a podcast on
that. Yeah.
Telling your accountant things. But, you know, certainly with that, you know, we would have it skewed to potentially the partner that does earn less. And it might be that 99% of it is in one partner's name and 1% is another partner's name. So they're both still on it.
Yeah.
But literally all of the income is going to go to the partner with, the lowest.
And obviously understanding how long you're going to hold that asset for.
That's right.
Like ideally you want to make some money, but yeah, how's that going to be? Is it a quick turnover in 12 months, 2 years, especially in the from like Bitcoin and things like that where it might be just really short, sharp trades?
Yeah, no, correct. But it could be. But, you know, looking at, I guess, each individual's sort of trajectory and what they do for a career and that sort of thing, if you can sort of tell that one person's always going to earn two or three times more than the other, it might be a fairly easy decision to make.
Mm. Cool.
A question here from Angelica Walsh. Charity donations,
yes.
Is there a maximum that you can claim?
The only thing with donations, you can't go into a loss with donations. So no real maximum, but if you did end up spending $100,000 on donations and you only earned $60,000 and it actually forces you into a loss position, then you sort of lose that amount below.
That happened to me the year after I sold my business. I didn't earn any income and I gave a heap of money away that was tax deductible. And my tax return was – so my notice of assessment where it says your taxable income –
zero.
No, it said minus
minus,
you know, 20,000 or whatever it was. Like, it was, yeah, wild.
And so, I'm
like,
in that example of the 60K, it caps, it stops at the 60, does it?
Well, it won't stop, but the thing is you just lose, you can't put yourself into a loss position with donations, yeah. So you just lose whatever you've gone above and beyond.
Yeah. So the 40 income. Over is just not money down wasted. The drain. It's a nice feel.
Well, the government aren't going to be like, oh, we're going to just give you money out of nowhere.
Mm. Correct. Yeah. So, you know, it looks a beautiful gesture and you're obviously very charitable.
Yep, well done.
But you can't put yourself in a loss position.
If I would have known, I wouldn't have done it. I would have waited the next financial year.
Talk to your accountant before you did it.
Yeah, I'm that guy.
There we go. Full circle.
Totally. Let's have a look. There's another. A lot of these questions are kind of the same.
What about Jamie Wood at the bottom there?
Yeah.
Common things FIFO workers can claim if their employer supplies most things for them. Zero.
Yeah.
Qantas Club membership.
Yeah. So look, with these guys, there's nothing, again, you know, although it's a certain field of work, there's nothing necessarily specific to a FIFO worker. You know, obviously they do a lot of travel. However, anything that's connected to your home, your actual main residence, wherever that might be in the country, anything to or from that place of residence is exempt, unfortunately. And that goes for everyone. If we leave our house and go to work, that trip is not covered. So anything with a personal nature attached to it at either end, whether you're coming or going from home, is strictly non-deductible for everyone.
Yeah. So there needs to be a destination in the middle, essentially.
Correct.
Doesn't it?
Yeah. So say if you flew to WA to go to your work site, and they're we need to put you up here, and they probably paid for it anyway. But if you did any travel between two places of work, or projects or that sort of thing, then that's all deductible. Look, with these people, there's normally a lot of licenses that are required. So you might have memberships, you might have union fees, any of those sorts of things that have a direct connection to what you do. Look, if you have a membership to, you know, Foxtel, then that's not necessarily going to have a connection to your work. But if you need a heavy rigging license and things like that, then there's that direct connection to what you do. As well as, you know, with clothing, a lot of your uniform and things like that are quite specific. Again, if it's been paid for, then you can't claim that. But if you are going out and finding that you're having to get protective wear, like special sunglasses, special boots, all of that sort of thing, and then that flows into tools and equipment. So if you do need any specific things for your job that is not paid for by your employer, that also is available.
Side question, asking for a friend, when can you claim Foxtel?
Maybe if you were in the gambling, you know, you're a
what about a if you run a money podcasting business and I need
you need the business channel.
I do.
Well, look, you could argue that there was a business portion there, but whether it's 100% business would be something that you would have to determine.
What if 100% business is 100% of my pleasure?
Try telling that to the AGO and let me know how you go.
Yeah, that's right.
I'd be really interested to hear the outcome.
I think I actually cancelled my Foxtel after my friend moved to America because he was the only one who watched it. Mm. There's a question here. Oh, actually, just the work from home stuff. I was just thinking, if, for example, you are working from home and you start at 8:30 or 9 in the morning from home, and then they said, all right, everyone, work from home in the morning, drive over, come in for a 2 o'clock meeting, go back home. Technically, can I claim cents per kilometre if I'm driving into the office because I started at home and I'm finishing at home?
Well, it's still got that personal element. There is some carve-outs for if you have to carry bulky goods. So say you're a PE teacher and you have to carry around a whole bunch of soccer balls and stuff like that. Even if you're coming from going from home and there's things that you must have with you, then there is exemptions around that sort of thing. But with that personal connection, it's just very hard to argue.
And it's important to highlight that, you know, a lot of people go, oh, I've got the best accountant, like she claims everything for me and we get the biggest tax return. It's like, that's cute. If it's wrong, she's not going to jail. No. You are.
Well, that is correct. The onus is on the taxpayer and that's you.
Yeah, and so, that sucks.
Yeah. you can sue them, and you know, but at the end of the day, we, if you actually read your letter, your cover letters that you'll receive with your end of year packs, we basically disclaim everything away. So, you know, if you're going to try and take sort of that back on them, it's going to be very hard for you, because that's the ATO's view. It is you.
And just there's another question here about crypto. Sumi says, you know, how to work out crypto and paying CGT, or if there's specialized accountants for this. I mean, when it kind of first started taking off, there were accountants saying we're crypto specialists. At the end of the day, it's an asset.
Correct. It's like a share.
Yeah.
So it gets no special treatment at this point in time. Look, they might change in the future, well, but right now.
Yeah, I will say, if you hold cryptocurrency and you hold it to actually trade and use as a currency, it's not treated as a CGT event.
Yeah, so if you're holding and trading, though, so almost like a business.
Well, no, I mean, if you're literally, I'm buying my car with crypto, I'm buying my food with crypto, I'm using it as actual day-to-day currency, it's treated like cash.
Free.
Oh, I got you.
Yeah.
So, but I mean, no one's
Is that you, Glenn?
No.
Who is doing that?
Well, and this is it. Like, you see all these, like, Teslas come out. Like, you can buy a Tesla with crypto. It's like the way it's behaving and how volatile it is. Mm. You know, if you bought your Tesla yesterday with Bitcoin and it dropped 50% overnight.
Yeah, which it could.
That Tesla's cost you a lot of money.
Correct.
If it went up 50%, we got the best deal in the world. So I think it's just let's just chill out, everyone, with this crypto stuff just for 10 hot minutes and don't overdo it.
Yes.
Hannah Warhurst. We might finish up with this one. Do you want to read that, John? Top of the second page.
Yes. So Hannah says, what to do is side hustle income under sole trader ABN. How does one tax themselves? At one point, do you need to tax your side hustle, a.k.a. any side hustle tax tips?
Probably covered a little bit of this
under the sole trader stuff, but
yeah. So with whether it's a side hustle, you're a sole trader. Again, you're still at individual level, so you're being taxed at your marginal rate. Look, in relation to the side hustle, that all comes down to frequency and just how involved you are in that. So if that's more of a hobby, then that's going to be the point where you're doing it fairly infrequently. You know, probably less than once a month.
Yeah,
and that's going to stay sort of in your personal realm.
Does the word intent come into this?
Well, that's right. If there is intent there to make money, that's a profit making, and that goes across the board for basically any company. Yeah. If it's a profit making venture and that is what your intent is to start with, then that's what the ATO looks for. But it's all about that frequency. So if you're doing this sort of week in, week out, you know, you're it doesn't even necessarily matter how much money you're making, but you're putting a lot of effort into it. You've maybe advertised for it.
Yeah.
And it's sort of, you're putting yourself out there to the wider public. If you're just doing it, say you're just doing it for friends and family and really just the people that know you, if you're then suddenly putting out to public consumption and you're actually helping the public at large and offering your services, it's becoming a bit more than a side hustle.
And they can check that nowadays with how much marketing you're doing online, et cetera.
Well, absolutely. That's right. And, you know, I have heard, the ATO, see things on Gumtree. Yeah. They see, eBay. If there's things that are popping up on a very frequent occurrence, they can tell that you're running a business as opposed to a hobby.
So this is probably a story for another day, but when we look at sole trader versus PTYLTD company, when do you make the decision, I'm going to start up as this and change over, or just start up and just let it run?
Yeah, look, that's a good question. And look, there is some very different taxing, points there, because with a company, the actual company tax rate is coming down as we speak.
Mm.
So in 2022, we're coming down to 25%, which is it's a great rate. Like, when you compare it to the individual tax rates, there would only be, two that are under that, and that's the tax rate threshold and then the 19%. So, there's a huge advantage there from a tax perspective. Now, the only thing you do need to consider is if you are doing something that a business that requires your skill and knowledge, or say you're an electrician, for example, you're working for yourself, that work is purely consists of, you know, yes, you use drills and tools and that sort of thing, but that work and that business purely consists of your skill and your knowledge in that area. So without you, there is no business, and that's what we call personal services income. So in the event that you went from a sole trader and you're going into that sort of company and that's how your business is run, unfortunately, you would still be taxed at your marginal rate and not the company rate.
Interesting, because, yeah, there's implications with insurance depending on the trade too, isn't there?
Well, absolutely. And yeah, so you can sort of get caught up in there if you're, say, a manicurist or someone that sort of uses actual tools and that sort of thing for your work, then you may be able to get around those personal services income rules. But that's going to be the biggest thing that's going to hold you back from getting the advantage of the company tax rate. In saying that, look, there is also a lot of compliance that goes with running a business, yep. So and a company structure. You know, there's sort of yearly fees to ASIC to manage that, as well as your compliance. Like, you're probably going to triple your compliance costs with a company. But look, you're probably going to be looking at, you know, when you start getting up into incomes of $100,000+, that's when you're going to start, you know, paying some serious tax.
Yep,
and it might be something that you then look into moving over into a company.
Mm, cool.
Sorry, guys. I was silent for a few minutes. I was just on my phone. I don't trust you guys.
Quite soothing, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. I should spend more time on my phone during episodes. But I guess I just want to, you know, we've covered a bit of ground and, you know, it's the same thing. Like, you just need personal attention from a professional. And, you know, I don't have a horse in this accountant race. So reach out to Altus. I'm sure your team will talk to anyone for 15 minutes. There's a link in the show notes.
Absolutely. Happy to.
And I don't know. It's just, it's okay to pay for advice. It's okay to pay for help. And
yeah, I think you mentioned it before. It's like, when you're starting your own business, you're a specialist in some field, aren't you? So you outsource what you're not good at.
Mm. Absolutely.
Focus on what you are good at and let the rest sort it out.
And sure, if you're a PAYG employee, pay-as-you-go employee, you don't have any real deductions or anything, sure, knock yourself out, use MyGov.
Yeah.
But as soon as you get one little curly thing like I'm working from home and it could get tricky, or you just want some help, like, it's okay to pay for it.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Mm. And yeah, because it gets complicated. Like I said, it's almost like a foreign language. Mm. So, you know, we're there to just ask questions.
And the accounting fee can be deductible.
Well, that's right.
For a long year.
Correct. Or you prepay it and it's deductible in the current year.
Giddy up. Sarah, any final words about all these questions that you've seen today?
No, look, it was a really, you know, broad-based approach and some broad topics. So it was really great. Join you guys and thank you for having me. Happy to help anyone with any questions or, you know, sit down and have a chat. That's what we're here for. So
yeah. And Altus, you guys help people all over Australia, which is cool. So,
well, that's right. You know, after now that we're all working from home and with Zoom and Teams, you can be anywhere in the world and
absolutely
you can be there.
You can be talking to your accountant and their cat can be walking across the keyboard. It can just get wild.
I don't have a cat, but yes, I'm sure that does happen.
Oh, yeah. Well, I know it is Glenn.
No, well, there's actually, so I'm on my, whatever. It's a story for another after party. Yeah. We'll leave it there. I will see you guys soon. If you've got any other random questions, throw them up in the Facebook group and we can have a discussion in there about it.
That's it. Thanks, Sarah.
Thanks, Sarah.
Thanks, guys.
Bye. Bye.
We acknowledge the Darkin Young people, traditional custodians of the land on which our studio sits, and pay respect to their elders, past and present. We extend that respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples who may listen to our podcast.
My Millennial Money supports A21, a charity focused on abolishing slavery and human trafficking all over the world. Check out a21.org.au for more info. If you would like some other giving options, or if you're unsure about which charity you can support, head to thelifeyoucansave.org.au.
This podcast is for education and entertainment purposes. Any advice is general financial advice only, which does not take into account your objectives, financial situation, or needs. Because of that, you should consider if the advice is appropriate to you and your needs before acting on the information. If you do choose to buy a financial product, read the product disclosure statement and obtain appropriate financial advice tailored to your needs. Symo Interactive Proprietary Limited, the publisher of the podcast, is an authorised representative of Money Sherpa Proprietary Limited, which holds financial services license 451289.